Okay? Right, the first audio file I haven't uploaded yet. The other thing is, I see a few of you have got laptops. I'm afraid I don't know what the wireless password is because it changes every month and this is our first day back. But again, I've emailed someone from the wired connection to ask them to let me know, and then I should be able to pass that on to you later. Okay, so just a few more slides in this introductory section to give you a base of background knowledge and definitions to work on later. And what we see here is the bivariate normal distribution. So the functional form of it looks a bit complicated, but in actual fact, it's a sort of workhorse of much data analysis to do with, you know, two quantities varying. And of course, a very straightforward example of where you might want to use the bivariate normal is if you're trying to fit a straight line to data. So you've got one quantity varying against another, you're trying to see if it's well fitted by a straight line. So we'll look at that in the next section and then go on to nonlinear models as well, a bit more advanced stuff. But just to give you some pictures of what the bivariate normal looks like, well, just looks like that. It looks like a hill. So you've got two variables, x and y, and you've got your Gaussian peak. So any section through that three-dimensional plot, well, two-dimensional rendering, would be a Gaussian. And overall, it's got this sort of Gaussian hill shape. So there are various parameters that describe that bivariate normal. There's the mean value of x and the mean value of y, usually denoted mu sub x, mu sub y. There's the variance of x, the variance of y. But there's an additional fifth parameter, and that's where it is slightly less straightforward. We call this parameter the correlation coefficient, denoted usually by the Greek letter rho. And that's formally defined by the equation in the red box. That's the expected value of x minus the mean of x times y minus the mean of y. And that is equal to, this is how rho is defined, rho times the standard deviation of x times the standard deviation of y. So in particular, that means if x and y are independent, then rho is going to be zero. And in a great deal of physical sciences data analysis problems, often what you're trying to do is to see whether one quantity really is independent of another. And one way to address that is to calculate this correlation coefficient. We'll see tomorrow that the correlation coefficient being zero doesn't guarantee independence. It guarantees the variables are uncorrelated, but that's actually not the same as being independent. We'll get to that distinction tomorrow. But if they are independent, then it applies the other way around. If they are independent, then the correlation coefficient will be zero. The quantity in the left-hand side of the red box, that's known as the covariance. And a term which some of you may have heard, certainly those who've heard about Fisher information matrices, will probably also have heard about covariance matrices. And that's something we're going to spend a lot of time talking about tomorrow. So the covariance is just the simplest example of a covariance matrix, because it's a single number, but that's a one-by-one matrix. But we can define the covariance matrix more generally, as you'll see a bit later. So for any two variables, you can define the covariance of x and y as the expected value of x minus the expected value of x times y minus the expected value of y. So the notation, of course, does wind up looking a bit clumsy and rather dry and abstract, so it's maybe best to think about it in terms of some pictures. And these are probably pictures that you've seen in some form or another before. What you see here, the formal definition of what they are is isoprobability contours. They're contours which represent areas of the xy plane where the bivariate normal distribution would have equal probability. So if rho equals zero and x and y are independent, then the isoprobability contours are circles, or more generally ellipses, which are oriented to be such that the major axis and minor axis of the ellipse is parallel to the x and y axis. If, however, rho is different from zero, then the ellipses start to tilt. And that's a way of graphically thinking about how x and y are correlated with each other. What that really means is that the value of x is linked to, correlated with, related to the value of y. So if you look at the plot, the more different from zero the correlation coefficient gets, then the more tightly constrained the value of y is, let's take this lower right hand panel where rho is 0.9, the more tightly constrained the value of y is for any given value of x. Because these probability contours would correspond to particular levels of probability, but if you sort of integrate across those contours, then what you're getting is a measure of how probable it is that y would, say, lie between this value and that one. So this is linked to something that's very, very, very common throughout the physical sciences, which is to represent fits to parameters of models in terms of what are usually called either confidence regions, or Bayesians call them credible regions. And you see, certainly if you work in cosmology, you see lots of plots with these sorts of elliptical, vaguely elliptical looking shapes. Sometimes they're a bit odder in shape, they can be more like bananas or, you know, really very peculiar shapes. But what they're supposed to represent is regions within which there's a certain probability of the parameters of a model lying. So right now we're introducing this bivariate normal distribution quite gently, just, you know, it's a function that describes probabilities of two things. We'll see a bit later on that very often those things are parameters of models we want to constrain, and therefore we can use the properties of the bivariate normal distribution to help us make statements about how probable it is that the parameter values lie within certain ranges. And of course, the slope of the contours is affected by the sign of the correlation coefficient. If the correlation coefficient is negative, then the slope will go from upper left to lower right. It basically means as x gets smaller, the tendency is for y to get bigger, rather than as x gets bigger, y gets bigger, which is what you see in the right-hand panels. Okay, so correlation coefficient is related to how we would go about fitting a straight line to data between x and y. We'll see that in just a few minutes. But the correlation coefficient is a good way of characterising how strongly linked the quantities x and y are. Of course, you'd expect, in many situations, the reason why they're linked statistically is because there's an underlying physical connection between them. It's not always the case, but that's kind of often what we're after. It's what we're exploring a plot like this for, is to see whether we can understand the physical reason why the value of y is related to the value of x. So the bivariate normal distribution, I said this just a moment ago, is related to how we would go about fitting straight lines to data. One way to see that, to introduce it, we'll look at it more carefully in a moment, is that if you look at the conditional distribution of y given x, that itself is a normal distribution, but instead of the mean being the mean of y overall, it's now a shifted mean that actually depends on x. But the equation for the mean is like the equation of a straight line. So if you fit a straight line to data x and y, then one can think of the equation of that straight line as being related to the conditional expectation of y given x. Actually, equally, you could think about it in relation to the conditional expectation of x given y, which is in a fancy way of saying that you can fit straight lines to data in more than one way, which again you might have encountered in the past, and sometimes it's a bit hard to determine which is the best straight line for the problem in question. We'll try and say a bit more about that later too. What you see here is that the variance, or rather the standard deviation, because I've square rooted things, the standard deviation of the conditional distribution, so it's y given x, it's sigma y times the square root of 1 minus rho squared. So the closer rho is to 1, the smaller that standard deviation is going to be. Which again is just consistent with what we saw in the last plot. The closer rho gets to 1, the tighter those contours get. So the more closely your data points will hug the best fitting straight line. Okay? I think I've already really said this, that mu y plus sigma y over sigma x rho x minus mu x, that's the straight line expression. Well, technically that's the equation of a straight line where we've conditioned y on x. As I said, you could do it the other way around as well. So the way we say that is it's the conditional expectation of y given x, and that equation is sometimes also known as the regression line of y on x, which is how a statistician will refer to the process of fitting a straight line between y and x. More generally known to physicists in terms of least squares, which is something we'll get to in section 2. And in fact, that is section 2, so that's we've got to the end of our section 1. I just hadn't wanted to detain you too long from lunch. Okay, so that's me covered, you know, quite a wide range of introductory nuts and bolts type stuff, some definitions, some notation. I will continue to introduce more as I go along, but now we turn our attention to some more kind of practically useful things, which are to do with how we estimate parameters of models and how we determine the goodness of fit of a model. These are things which I imagine you will have done a little of already, but you maybe won't have thought about in as deep a manner, and that's really what I'm aiming for here, is to get you engaged with that. Okay, so I'll stop for a few seconds and see whether anyone's got anything they want to ask or query or comment on. Can the folks at the back see the text okay? I'm appreciating that because we've moved to a warmer room, it's also a longer one, and it's maybe a wee bit small, but as I say, it's all online anyway, so I'm hoping you're not having to strain your eyes too much. Okay, well, let me know if there's anything that is either indistinct because it's too small or indistinct because it's not explained very well, and I'll see what I can do. Okay, so what we're moving on to then is parameter estimation. So we're going to begin by thinking about this in the classical frequentist way of doing things. Parameter estimation, from a frequentist point of view, in the end, you know, to actually go through the practical procedures isn't all that different from how you do it in a Bayesian way, but you're thinking about the problem slightly differently. So let me see if I can explain how. What you think about is having a random sample of data, m data points, where m is hopefully some quite large number, and you're assuming, in the frequentist way of thinking about this, that that random sample is drawn from, selected from, some underlying population, which you could in principle have observed as well, but you just either didn't have the time or the money or both to observe them all. So with your random sample, what you need to work out is something called the sampling distribution. So provided you know what that underlying population is, that tells you what the sampling distribution should be. It tells you what you expect your sample to look like, given the assumptions you've made about the underlying population. So that's going to depend on the underlying PDF. It's also going to depend on how big your sample is. That allows you then to define an estimator, which is the fancy name for some function of the sample. So it just depends on things you've gone and observed. But what the estimator is supposed to do is give you insight, allow you to estimate what the parameters of the underlying population are. So estimators have this sort of very formal definition. What they might then lead you to do is to question whether you had a good model in the first place. Is your estimator good enough? Is it acceptable for the given sample size? Now, what you can use to do that is something that's referred to as a hypothesis test. If you think back to the wee example I showed in the morning, where I had the 100 numbers drawn from a random number generator, and they were supposed to be all equally probable, but of course they were a bit up and down. But then we did it with 10,000, and it was a lot smoother. So your common sense would say the 10,000 is closer to a flat distribution. What a hypothesis test would do is provide you with a quantitative way to determine whether that's really true. So all of this machinery exists for parameter estimation and goodness of fit tests. So how do we decide what makes an acceptable estimator? What's a good one? What isn't? Well, here's an example. So this is sort of a fairly vague example, not designed to be too specific to one area of physics. I suppose it's really kind of motivated by me being an astrophysicist, but you know, lots of people have to do spectroscopy. So think about it in those terms. What you've got is some spectral line and you're trying to measure its wavelength. So the true wavelength, we don't know what that is, but we assume that it does exist, you know, that the spectral line has an actual wavelength. To a frequentist, the way you define that is you say that Z0, the true wavelength, is a fixed but unknown parameter. And what you've got to do is estimate it. So knowledge of the probability density function of the underlying population of wavelengths would allow you to compute a sampling distribution for two or any number of estimators, but I've selected two here, and they've got quite different properties. There's Z1 and Z2. We normally put a wee hat above them, Z1 hat, Z2 hat, to denote the fact that it's an estimator. So Z1, that is the sort of number you might get from really a sort of type of spectrometer you would maybe find in a university undergraduate lab. Not terribly high resolution, but hopefully not designed in such a bad way that it's going to give completely the wrong answer. What I mean by that, more precisely, is that if you were to repeat the observation with that spectrometer a large number of times, then sometimes you would get too small a wavelength, sometimes you would get too large a wavelength, but on average, you would get the right answer. Such a spectrometer would be described as unbiased, and you've represented the sampling distribution as a broad Gaussian, but centred on the true value. The second point to make, though, is that although it's unbiased and the expected value is the true wavelength, it's got a large variance. So if you only do the observation once, you might get quite a different value from the real answer. Like your estimate might be over here or over there. On the other hand, your estimator could be like Z2 hat, which is shown by the distribution on the right. In that case, it's biased. The expected value of Z2 hat is not equal to the true value. But it does at least have quite a small variance. Now, why might it be biased? It might be because it's just been wrongly calibrated. I mean, it could be for a really stupid reason because, you know, NASA's fallen foul of a few examples of this, where things have been supposedly calibrated in imperial units, but then another group working in the team thought it was done in metric units. In fact, that caused one of the Mars probes to crash, which was a bit embarrassing. So wrongly calibrated equipment can be just as bad as insensitive equipment. However, in a way it's not so bad, because although the bias is there, it's quite large, the variance is small, and if you can somehow identify that you've got a biased estimator and correct for it, then you're back in business. So Z2 hat is probably the better choice of estimator, provided you can correct for the bias. And in many problems, it's kind of maybe a trade-off between bias and variance. You've got to live with a little bit of both sometimes. And what you want to do is to identify ways of defining optimal estimators that, optimise the adverse effect of both. But actually, in many situations, it's a lot less complicated than that. Because in actual fact, there are lots of kind of common sense estimators around, estimators that don't require a lot of hard work to come up with them. They're just kind of what your common sense would tell you to do. One of them you've probably been using for years, which is the sample mean. If you have a sample of values from some PDF, P of X, which has got mean mu and variance sigma squared, then you define the sample mean just in the common sense way. It's the sum of the x values that you sample divided by the number of values you've observed. And it's possible to show that the sample mean for any PDF, provided it's got finite variance, is an unbiased estimator. The bias is defined formally in terms of an infinite sample of randomly chosen samples, each of size m. So again, we've got this notion of having to repeat our observations with an imaginary set of observations that we never actually carried out. But nonetheless, the property of unbiasedness is still a good thing. What can you say, however, if you've only got a finite number of samples and with a finite size? Because practically, that's what you're more likely to have to deal with. Well, the way it works is this. Again, it's really just common sense. The common sense feature is that as M increases, the sample size increases, the variance of the sample mean gets smaller. So sigma squared is the variance of a single observation, and if you observe a certain number, M, and work out the mean of that total sample, then its variance will be smaller by a factor of M. So the bigger the sample, the closer the sample mean will be to the underlying population mean. So again, you'd hope that that's how things behave, because our common sense tells us that's how things ought to be. And then if we go back to that problem we discussed a few minutes ago of trying to look at correlations between variables, the bivariate normal was characterized by this correlation coefficient. Well, again, you might want to estimate that. How would you do that? Well, here's a formula for it. Again, I'm not going to sort of dwell on this. It's not sort of thing at this stage in your careers anyone would expect you to just remember in your head. You can go and look it up. But just to sort of think of where it's coming from, remember the expected value, or let's say it another way, the correlation coefficient was related to the covariance, which was the expected value of a product of things, x minus the mean of x multiplied by y minus the mean of y. Now, the mean of x and the mean of y, we don't know what those are. We can only sample them. We can only estimate them from a sample. So that's what x bar and y bar are here. And similarly, sx and sy, those are sample estimates of the standard deviation. And there's a sort of cunning little thing that because you want the sample mean and the sample standard deviation and the sample correlation coefficient, which I've denoted by R, to be unbiased estimates of their true values, which would be, you know, sigma x, sigma y, and rho, then what you wind up doing is you divide not by n, but you divide by n minus 1. That's a wee bit algebraically messy to prove that, but it is fairly straightforward to prove it. And I only mention it because, you know, again, this is an example of the Yoda thing. You've got to unlearn what you, or not so much unlearn what you've learned, but just think a bit more about things you might have learned in the past. Maybe in undergraduate labs, they told you that to work out the standard error and the mean, you divide by n minus 1 instead of by n. Don't know whether anyone bothered to tell you why, but it's to do with preserving your estimator as an unbiased estimator. Okay, you might think, what's the big deal? I just do it and don't ask questions. But suppose someone asks you in your Viva why you divided by n minus 1 instead of n. It's just good to be thinking about these things. Of course, reassuringly, if n's big, then it doesn't really make any difference. But if you're dealing with small samples, then these effects can be important. So always question where these formulae come from is the good moral. So if x and y do follow this bivariate normal distribution, then basically the R that we've defined here is indeed an estimator of the correlation coefficient rho that we introduced before. And since this is such a commonly used thing, there are various different ways of calculating R. They're all equivalent to each other, but you know they just take different forms depending on the problem. Some are more straightforward to work out than others. But frankly, nobody should have to actually stick the numbers into a calculator anymore. You can use Excel to do it, you can use MATLAB, you can use C or C++ or Fortran or any manner of programming languages to do all the donkey work for you. Notice though I've written up at the top linear correlation, and I think the next slide relates to that. Yeah, we've got another one of our pop question quizzes, pop quiz questions even. What I've asked you to do there is to estimate R for the sample data shown in the graph below. So that picture there, rather odd looking data set, admittedly. But what do you think the correlation coefficient is for that? Who thinks it's answer A? Answer B, C, and D. Yeah, very good, it's answer A. Because indeed, the correlation coefficient, if you formally work out from the formula, you're going to get zero, because there's a mean, which is bang in the middle of the distribution, and there's just as many points to the left as to the right, and just as many points above as below. So what this basically tells you is that fitting a linear model to that data is crazy. Now, hopefully none of you would do that, but, you know, certainly one thing we find a lot with our undergraduates is that if you give them a formula, they'll just apply it anyway, without thinking of whether it's the right thing to be doing. So what we'll see tomorrow, as we develop some of these Bayesian tools in a bit more depth, is that there are ways to avoid those pitfalls, because it's not always as obvious as this, that a model is crazy. Sometimes a model can look enticingly attractive, but it's still not the best model there is. So what we need is tools to do what is called model selection. And a kind of simple example would be if you've got some data and you're not quite sure whether you should fit a straight line or a cubic or a quartic, what do you do? Well, again, we'll look at that case tomorrow. In fact, we'll touch on it a bit later this afternoon as well, but we'll return to it tomorrow in more detail. So again, use with caution. The correlation coefficient is a good way of determining if things are uncorrelated, but only really good at exploring linear correlations. That means if X and Y kind of follow a straight line relation. If they follow something very different from a straight line relation, then really that's not the right way to be testing their independence. So a few slides ago we had this result that said that if you've got the sample mean and it's been constructed from m observations, then the variance of the sample mean goes down as 1 over m. So you get tighter and tighter around the true mean as the sample size goes up. We can actually take that a step further. There's a very powerful theorem in probability theory that says that for any PDF, as long as it's got finite variance, then as the sample size tends to infinity, the sample mean will start to look more and more like a normal distribution. Okay, so let's try and illustrate what's going on. So what we've got here is 1,000 samples of 10 objects. So I generated 10, then I did another 10, then another 10, then another 10, in total 1,000. And each one of those samples was drawn from an exponential distribution, so something that didn't look at all like the bell-shaped curve of a normal distribution. So for each of those 1,000 samples of size 10 in the top left corner, I calculate a mean. And then I've got myself 1,000 means. I can make a histogram of them. This is what I get. Yeah, it looks a bit lopsided. But suppose I did the same exercise, but this time the samples were 20 instead of 10. So I've got 1,000 of those. I get 1,000 sample means. I make a histogram. I do the same, but the sample size is 40, then 100. Notice that it's getting more and more like a normal distribution. So the central limit theorem, what it basically does is it provides us with an excuse, if you like, for why we do so much with the normal distribution. Because actually, if the things we're observing and the uncertainties we're trying to characterize are the result of the sum of lots of different effects, then the central limit theorem says that they ought to look like a normal distribution. So that's how a frequentist would interpret the prevalence of the normal distribution in probability theory. A Bayesian would take a slightly different slant on it, and it's to do with maximum entropy and making best use of the available information. We'll return to the Bayesian interpretation tomorrow. But in both cases, the reason why the normal distribution is used so much is not just because it's convenient or it's a simplification, it's because it really is a fundamentally important distribution. A lot of things in nature wind up having normal distributions because of the combination of lots of different effects all added together. And what the central limit theorem says is the more effects you add together, the more normal the result will look. So it's actually okay to assume things are normally distributed, provided those assumptions are satisfied. And in many situations they are. So that explains the importance of the normal. Okay, so now we start to kind of fight back a bit from the Bayesian side, because all of this frequentist parameter estimation using estimators and so on, it's still based on the asymptotic behaviour of an infinite ensemble of samples that we didn't actually observe. So if I wanted to be a really dyed-in-the-wool Bayesian, I'd be saying, yeah, but, you know, all this limiting behaviour of asymptotic distributions, what if I've only got one data set? What can I conclude then? We'll get back to that, but just keep that sort of Bayesian doubt in your mind. What we're going to do before we return and explore those Bayesian ideas more is we're just going to fairly swiftly go through some ideas about least squares and maximum likelihood. Maximum likelihood I'll do more slowly because I think that will be much less familiar to you. But what I want to do is introduce those ideas through, first of all, showing you something that I think most of you will have seen before, which is using least squares to fit straight lines to data. And that will be our kind of test bed for ideas that we can then scale up to more complicated problems, more realistic problems. Okay? So we're going to begin with least squares. So this is really a sort of workhorse method that's used throughout the physical sciences. You know, it's introduced at undergraduate level. In fact, I think, you know, some people might have even met it in A-level or advanced higher. The problem is, though, it's often encountered as just a black box. You're given a formula, or worse, you're just given a code that does it for you without really, you knowing what's going on. But nonetheless, I think it's a useful demonstration of some of the underlying principles, so we're going to spend a little time looking at it. We'll begin with what's called ordinary least squares. This is the one that you've probably met. You may have met variations on it too, but everyone, if they've met least squares at all, will have encountered this one. Again, I won't read all the text, it's there for you to consult later, but just let me pick out the details. Essentially, what you're doing is you're taking a set of numbers x and a set of numbers y, and you're assuming that there's a straight line relation that exists between them. So every y value, y sub I, is related to its corresponding x value by the relation a plus bx plus epsilon I. Epsilon is known as the residual of the ith data point, more colloquially, the error on the ith data point. Okay? So our task is to determine the values of a and b. And you've probably all seen something along these lines before. What we do in least squares is we construct an estimator of a and b by first of all computing a quantity called s, sometimes also referred to as chi-squared for reasons that will become clear very shortly if you don't know about chi-squared already. And s is the sum from I equals 1 to n of yi minus a plus bxi all squared. So the least squares estimators of a and b minimise that sum of squares. That's why we call it least squares. So if we work out ds by dA and ds by dB and set both of those equal to 0, then you get your estimates of a and b. So I'm kind of figuring a lot of you will have seen this, something like this before. So our s is the sum of the epsilon I squared, and that leads us to rather nasty looking formulae for a and b. Again, no one really at this stage of your careers needs to memorise the formulae, as long as you have a feel for where they come from and then you can kind of tell if the answer you're getting is wildly wrong. But in all practical situations I can think of, what you'd be doing is using a computer package to work these things out for you. Okay, so those are the formulae. And it's possible to show that the expectation value of a hat and the expectation value of b hat are both zero. And you can also work out the variance on a and the variance on b. And indeed, you can also work out the covariance on a and b hat. Now, what do I mean by that? We've introduced the notion of covariance already. So covariance was all to do with a measure of how correlated, how related one quantity was to another. So what this is telling us, even for a really simple problem, like ordinary least squares, which many of you will have met before, maybe early in your undergraduate course, you might not have encountered this idea before. So the covariance of A and B, what that says is that our estimate of the slope and the zero point, those estimates are correlated with each other. They're connected. So the formula that says how they're connected is given on the right there. But that gives us something interesting to think about. Because notice that the covariance of A and B covariance of A hat and B hat, I should be explicitly stating the hat because they're estimators. That covariance, it depends on the sum of the xi's. So the x's, you know, just think of any problem. It might be, say, you're measuring the pressure of a gas as a function of time. Well, the xi's would be the times at which you carry out your observations. Or it might be you're measuring the temperature of the microwave background at different positions on the sky. The xi's would be the positions at which you make your measurements. Whatever the context of your problem, this is called the dependent variable. It's something which you've kind of got control of. You can choose what x values you adopt. So the point I'm making is that you have it within your power to choose the sum of the xi's to be zero, which would mean that your estimate of A and B are independent of each other. Okay, maybe that's no big deal, but in many physical problems, there are parameters that you want to try and estimate which are going to be correlated with other parameters. What you'd really like is to get an estimate of parameter 1 that doesn't depend on the value of parameter 2. What this formula here gives is a first inkling that there might be a way to do that. Now, this is just a real simple problem. It's just fitting a straight line to data. What we'll see tomorrow, I'm sorry I keep sort of trailing things that are coming up, but you know, again, it's some sort of drip feeding this, anticipating that for many, you know, if I'd come straight in with all the multivariate stuff, it would have been a bit too much. What we'll do is we'll look tomorrow at how that sort of approach can scale up to problems that don't just involve two variables, but many more. And what we can do is we can, instead of, as you might see here, you're setting the covariance equal to zero, what you can do in a bigger problem is you can diagonalize what's called the covariance matrix. So if you've got many parameters in a problem and you want them all to be independent of each other, you can do it. Sometimes it's a challenge, but you can do it. And the technical term for this is called experimental design. It's all about choosing carefully how you carry out your experiment so that the end result has got some desirable property. In this case, the parameters that you estimate being independent of each other. Now, that all might just sound like, you know, rather abstract and esoteric niceties for the kind of, you know, mathematically obscure, but it can actually be really economically important as well. Because if you, like, again, forgive me for making this a cosmology example, but it's the ones I know best. Big business right now in cosmology is designing galaxy surveys or space probes that will try to measure a certain parameter to do with the acceleration of the universe. And many of those projects have a stated goal that they want to measure that parameter to 1%. No, that's a good thing, but if you're trying to persuade funding bodies to give you billions of dollars to go off and do that, you'd better be able to convince them that once you've done your experiment, you really will know that parameter to 1%. So this kind of experimental design approach is one way in which you can do that. And the same sort of thing has been done within, say, the particle physics world or the nuclear physics world, where experiments are designed and the results are sort of anticipated in advance so that you can determine how to do the experiment to maximize the scientific return. Okay? So, in a way, although much of this course is about giving you formulae and practical examples and all that, it's also maybe just about changing your thinking about data analysis. That data analysis is actually something you can do before you've got any data. And that sounds a bit weird, but that's how it ought to be. It's no longer the case that we can afford in big science projects to just kind of try something and hope for the best. Okay, many of you are maybe doing smaller scale science projects, but I'm sure you don't want to get 2 years into your thesis and discover that experiment you did in your first 6 months didn't go anywhere. It's much better to try and design things ahead of time to optimize your chances of getting a good result. Okay? Now, I'm not going to be able to cover all the details of that in just 2 days, but I'll be able to give you some examples of where those techniques have been used to great effect in certain problems. Again, many of you may have heard of this. The aspect of it I've just been alluding to do with the acceleration of the universe and dark energy. Essentially what this boils down to is something called principal component analysis. So again, just out of interest, how many people have heard of that? Well, again, not many. So I think one of the things I'd hope to do from these 2 days was to let more of you find out a bit about principal component analysis. So again, that's coming ahead tomorrow morning. Okay, back to the more simple stuff of just ordinary least squares. Let's look at some variations on it. What about weighted least squares? Now that's where the observations have measurement errors, but the measurement errors aren't all the same size. So again, I imagine many of you will have met something like this before. What you do in this case is you do a fit where the quantity you minimise, S, has the sigma I, which is the standard deviation of the ith observation. Think of that as like the size of the error bar of the ith observation. It's an indication of how big you expected the residual to be. And it's a way of downweighting data points which aren't really very good so that they don't affect your result too much. You carry out the rest of the procedure in just the same way, and you get even nastier looking formulae for the best fitting straight line and intercept, best fitting slope and intercept. Again, you can work out their variance, their covariance, and just as before, you have it within your power to arrange things by judicious selection of the xi's so that the estimate of the slope and the zero point are independent of each other. That's this very simple example of experimental design. Okay, and reassuringly, if you set all the sigma i's to be the same as each other, then the formulae reduce to the simple formulae we had before. So if you've got yourself a package that does weighted least squares, well, should work. And I guess a good way to check it's working is to make sure that all your error bars are the same size and see if you get the same answer as you would have done with an unweighted ordinary least squares fit. What about extensions and generalizations? I know that for many of you, you're already perhaps dealing with problems that go way beyond just fitting straight lines to data, the kind of thing you've done as undergraduates perhaps. What about if you've got errors in both variables? I'm afraid there, you've really got to resort to numerical methods. I mean, since for all practical purposes, you're going to have to work stuff out in a computer anyway, then it doesn't really make all that much difference. The practical difference is that you can't even write down an analytic formula for what the best fitting line is. But in a way you could say, who cares, because the computer's going to tell me what it is anyway. But what you do if you've got errors in both variables is you modify your merit function. So the one we had before was the sigma I on the denominator. That was weighted least squares. So now what we've got is a sigma xi and a sigma yi, because there's errors on both. But we've also got this b. Now that's a real pain, because what it means is that the function you're trying to minimise, which we're calling chi-squared for reasons of its connection to the chi-squared goodness of fit test that we'll explore shortly. The chi-squared, well, you've got this sum. With the b in the denominator, that really torpedoes any chances you had of finding a simple analytic solution. It means that it's got to be done numerically. There are iterative methods to do it. There are just essentially an exhaustive search through your parameter space of trying lots of values of a and b and seeing which one gives you the smallest chi-squared. And indeed, the situation gets worse if you've got more than two variables, as you might have. So no simple analytic solution, and just because I've been using it for a while, I've put in a specific reference to the numerical recipes chapter that discusses this case. So, you know, you might not want to use their code, but the good thing about numerical recipes, it always gives you a few pages of chat before each of the codes to kind of explain what they do and explain the context of the problem. And even if that's the only thing you do, it's well worth a look at that because it just helps you to see where the method will work and where it won't work. Now what about if you've got more than two variables? I've already said that sometimes it gets complicated, but actually sometimes it's actually not too much harder. Let's look at this example. So what I've got is y of x is like a polynomial. The polynomials are not straight lines, that's for sure. But the thing is, the linearity of the problem is to do with the parameters you're trying to estimate, not the values of x. So if the things you're trying to estimate are e1, e2, and so on, then actually, even though this thing looks a mess, it's still a linear problem. So the chi-squared we're trying to estimate is yi, well now instead of minus a plus bxi, we've got a whole sum of terms. But, you know, we can represent that polynomial in terms of quite a compact sum. And essentially, all that happens is the thing turns into a matrix equation. Then there's a nice section of numerical recipes that goes through some of the gory details. And I've just reproduced one or two aspects of it here. The way it works is, you've got a vector of observations, you've got a vector of parameters you're trying to model, and you've got a matrix of basis functions, which in the previous slide were things like the x squared, the x to the n minus 1. They could be anything. They could be sines, cosines, Bessel functions, Chebyshev polynomials, whatever. You just put them all together in a big matrix, and the problem you're trying to solve is to find the vector A, which is the best fit to that matrix equation. So everything we looked at for the ordinary least squares, where you just did y's and x's, extends to the case of vectors. And most modern computer packages, especially things like MATLAB, which are ideally suited to vectorization, will work almost as fast for this sort of case. And again, if you've got errors, you can wait by them and tackle the problem in a similar way. You get something called a design matrix, which is the analogue of the matrix I called X before. So what you're trying to minimise is small a, the model parameters, which gives the best fit to that matrix equation. So all I'm trying to do here is just to sketch through a few of the points. It's clearly the case if you've got a problem that would require you to work on this, you're going to have to go away and have a read of some stuff, think about it a bit more. You're not just going to get the blinding insight into how to solve the problem from me rattling on about it for 5 minutes. But I just want to indicate what some of the potential problems are and how you might overcome them. You see, the formal solution to this matrix equation looks like this. Our estimate of all the A's, because remember that's a vector of things, is the inverse of an n by n matrix, which is A transpose A, times A transpose, times the vector of all the data, B. Moreover, the covariance of A transpose, of A, small a, is the inverse of A transpose A. So, inverting matrices can be fraught with danger. So that's one of the things I wanted to highlight, again, just sketching it. Inverting A transpose A can be hazardous, particularly if A is a sparse matrix. That means if a lot of the entries of A are zero, or if it's close to singular, which means it doesn't actually have an inverse. Some inversion methods will not really be well suited to that situation. Okay, they'll give you an answer, but the answer will be highly unstable. Because if you change the values in your matrix just a little bit, and after all these are supposed to be observed things, so they're going to have an error, then it will change the best fit solution a great deal. So there's a nice remedy, there's a variety of ways to tackle this problem, but the one I thought it was worth flagging is something called singular value decomposition. So there's some sort of boring maths algebra stuff, some of you might have come across this in maths courses before, whereby it says how you can decompose any matrix into a diagonal matrix, a set of orthogonal columns, and the transpose of an orthogonal matrix. So don't worry about those technical details. As I say, clearly if you had to apply this, you'd have to go away and read a bit more about it anyway. But let me just try and let you see what the key idea is. The idea is that you've got your matrix, your design matrix, which is based on all your observations, and you recognise that that can be sort of split up into these different things. It can be split up into the diagonal matrix in the middle, and then these other two matrices on the outside. So a package like MATLAB, you feed it a matrix and it will just give you those back. You don't have to do anything, it does all the work for you. Okay, so what are we supposed to do with that? Well, here's the point. The formal solution to the least squares problem in this multivariate case, there's a set of parameters you're interested in, and that is given in terms of the matrices that come out of the single value decomposition. And the matrix that was in the middle of the singular value decomposition, the diagonal one, had elements wi. So let's just go back to that slide. See the wi's down the diagonal, everything else is zero. Now those elements, wi, are going to range in size. There's going to be some big ones, there's going to be some small ones. Now what you can see from the equation in that red box is that the small ones are potentially very bad news, because if they are so small that they're down at the sort of machine precision accuracy of your computer, then they're going to, when you invert them, become really, really big. And therefore they're going to affect the solution very sensitively. Okay? So the clever bit about singular value decomposition is that you're allowed to do something which you're almost never allowed to do, which is to set infinity equal to zero. And that's because what you do is you take those very small values of wi, which would amplify any round-off errors in your data, and you set them such that 1 over wi doesn't equal a very large number, instead it just equals zero. You effectively just switch off those contributions to the solution. Now the reason you're allowed to do that is all because you've got yourself a diagonal matrix. So each of those wi's doesn't really affect other bits of the matrix. It doesn't affect the other wi's. So in a sort of hand-wavy fashion, setting them to zero doesn't really do any harm. At least what it doesn't do is it doesn't spread that effect through the rest of your solution. So in particular, what it does is it suppresses the noisy contribution coming from those small values and stops it polluting your solution. So singular value decomposition is very closely related to the technique I mentioned a few minutes ago called principal component analysis, and it can often be used as a noise filter. It's used in a wide variety of problems. I'll return to it in section 5, and I've dug out some problems, well, just some illustrations, from a colleague of mine who works in biophysics. He is a statistician, but he's doing work in gene sequencing and using singular value decomposition to clean up the noisy output from gene sequencing programs. It's also very commonly used in astrophysics and in particle physics. So it's a powerful technique, and the main moral here is that if you just naively try and invert a matrix without doing something like SVD, then the chances are your solution may be wildly unstable. So whether or not you would need such a technique really will just depend on your problem, but the main thing is just to think a bit about how your answer from whichever problem you're tackling might be sensitive to these kind of issues. Okay? Couple more extensions to this simple least squares. Well, the main one that some of you will probably have already met is the idea of nonlinear models, where the yi, the predicted value of y, depends in some complicated nonlinear way on the x and also on the parameters. So you want to minimize this quantity s or chi squared, and you do it by constructing something that looks just like it was before. It's just that the yi model term is now a very complicated function of the parameters. So how are you going to minimize that? Well, you can begin in essentially the same way. You can set ds by d theta I, where theta is the parameters, you set that equal to zero. To take you back to, we've come a long way in 10 minutes since I've, you know, begun with this very simple ordinary linear straight line. What we did to solve the linear problem was we set ds by dA equals zero, ds by dB equals zero, and we came up with a formula for A and for B. So you're actually doing the same thing. The trouble is you can't come up with a formula because the equations are non-linear. So what are you going to do? Well, there's a variety of possibilities, but by far the most common is to do something that involves a Taylor expansion of the quantity S or chi-squared. Those are used almost interchangeably, around the minimum. So what you're really saying is that around the minimum, whatever that minimum is, you're assuming that the shape of the chi-squared function can be described by like a quadratic. And it can be a quadratic in multiple dimensions, which is a bit hard to visualize. But we see it here just shown in cross-section for x versus y. So basically how many of these methods work, including a very common one called Leavenberg-Marquardt gradient descent, is that you work out what the gradient of chi-squared is at your local point in the parameter space, and you head in the direction where the gradient is going downhill fastest. Again, the beauty of all of this is you don't really need to do any of it because it's all done by a computer package. What's the big drawback of such a method? Well, it works just fine if there's only a single minimum. But what if there's lots of minima? You could wind up getting stuck in the wrong minimum. So tomorrow we're going to look at a range of methods that try to overcome that, using, on the one hand, Markov chain Monte Carlo methods, and then actually another one is using something called genetic algorithms, which is especially well suited to avoid getting stuck in local minima. But the idea behind it is basically pretty sound. Going in the direction where the chi-squared is dropping fastest, if it's a nice, smooth, well-defined surface with a single global minimum, then it should find it pretty fast. So that's one way to go. Again, there's some good stuff in numerical recipes to flesh out some of the details that I don't have time to do here today. What if the errors are correlated with each other? Because we've assumed, I don't even think I said this, but we've assumed up till now that all the errors are unrelated. The error on this data point isn't connected at all to the error on a neighbouring data point. If only that were true in many physics problems. Instead, what we often find is that the errors are correlated. Well, again, you can do that. This is a case that even numerical recipes doesn't cover, but it's covered in quite good detail in Chapter 10 of Phil Gregory's book. And you just calculate a chi-squared as before, but what you've got to do is work out something called the covariance matrix, which I've mentioned once or twice already, and we'll look at more thoroughly tomorrow morning. Okay. Now, Chapter 3 in Sivia, that gives a pretty clear discussion of least squares within the Bayesian framework. So I'm not going to cover that here. I'm just going to mention something, and again it's a way of checking whether people have heard about this, that in the frequentist framework we usually assume that we know what the errors are, we know what the sigmas are. That's what your error bars, you know the size of them. What if you don't? Well, the Bayesian methods can handle that too, but instead of working with your normal distribution as your kind of building block, what you have to use is something called the student's t distribution. Anyone heard of the student's t distribution? It's got quite an interesting backstory. It was actually developed by a researcher who was employed by Guinness in Ireland to do studies of their the quality of their beer. And you know, he realised that because of certain details of his analysis that it wasn't a normal distribution he wanted. He wanted another type of distribution. He was too modest to give it his own name, so it's come to be known as the student's t distribution. Okay, now how are we doing? I know I've been talking for a while, it's a lot of stuff to bombard at you. What I'd like to do then is to go for just about another 10 minutes and then we'll stop and we'll have a nice leisurely half-hour coffee break, let you all kind of regain your equilibrium. And the material after the coffee break will be a bit less full-on, but it will start to look at the issues around Bayesian inference and choice of prior and a few things like that. And I'll also put my speakers to good use because I have some very helpful video clips by Simon Singh to try and illustrate some of the points I want to get across. So before we do that, let me just round off this current session by introducing something to do with maximum likelihood. Hello, Lynn. Okay, I've asked do you know if Valerie's in today? Ah, right, okay. The number is basically, it's a £22 menu and it's 44 people. Right. I'd emailed Valerie to ask her to do it, but I hadn't realised she was off. Thanks a lot, Lynn, if you wouldn't mind. That's our curry just being secured. So that was definitely worth stopping for. Okay, I was trying to phone Mother India at lunchtime, but they weren't answering, so they're now chasing up how many people are going. Okay, so let's just spend about 5 or 10 minutes introducing maximum likelihood, then we'll stop. So the principle of maximum likelihood, we're back to frequentist thinking here again for a minute. What we've got here is the idea of a parameter as a fixed constant. We don't know what the constant is, but we want to use our data to try and tell us what that constant ought to be. Now, how might we go about that? Well, we do it by computing this thing that we call the likelihood. So the likelihood measures the probability that if the parameter were equal to some value, that you would have obtained the data that you did actually obtain. So the likelihood function is what you do if you generate a whole family of curves just by varying that parameter theta. And the principle of maximum likelihood, what that says is that a good way to estimate theta is to choose the one that maximizes the likelihood. Again, it's a bit hard to get your head around with all the words and equations, so let's think about it in terms of a picture. Okay. Suppose we observe one single number, x, and that's its position on the line. And what we've got is some parameter theta, which, well, could be anything, could be something to do with, say, the gravitational constant, that would allow you to predict what value of x you expect to observe. So in particular, if theta were equal to theta 1, as shown here, then the sampling distribution for that value of theta would look like the green curve, and that would mean that the value of x that we actually observed was pretty unlikely. Okay? So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to change theta. I'm not going to change x because that's what we've observed. We're stuck with that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to imagine that maybe the parameter has a different value. Suppose theta was equal to theta 2, in which case I could work out that the sampling distribution of x takes the form of the new green curve. Well, the value of x is still pretty unlikely. In fact, it's even less likely than the last time. What about if theta takes on this value, theta 3? Well, in that case, the sampling distribution looks like this. The value of x is now a little bit more likely. The principle of maximum likelihood simply says that we choose the value of theta to be the one that makes our data sit right at the peak of the distribution. So it maximizes the likelihood that we would have obtained the data that we did actually obtain. Okay. Kind of subtle concept, but that's me trying to encapsulate it just in terms of the picture. Now, how does that connect to least squares? Well, the answer is actually very closely, but only if you're working with a normal distribution. Let me just quickly show you. So here's our least squares formula again. We're back to the simple case of just a straight line, y equals a plus bx. So the residuals are the errors, epsilon I. They've got some distribution. Sometimes they're positive, sometimes they're negative. We don't really know what the distribution is. Let's assume that their underlying distribution is as follows. They've got mean zero, they've got variance sigma I squared, and in fact you follow a Gaussian distribution. We can then construct a likelihood function. Now what form does that take? It looks a bit weird. First of all, it's a product. That's because we're assuming that each of the epsilon i's is independent of all the others. Okay? So we just multiply them all together. And because they're all Gaussians, it takes this form. And the epsilon I in here, we get that just by rearranging that formula. Okay, oops. I've actually given you the answer to the fifth pop quiz question, but that's a real test of whether you're staying awake. How can we justify writing the likelihood as a product? How can we get away with that? Is it because A, the residuals are all equal to each other? B, because the residuals are all Gaussian? C, because they're all positive? Or D, because they're all independent? D, isn't it? We've reached the point in the afternoon where even raising your arm requires more energy than is available. Don't worry, I'm going to stop in a minute. Okay, so you've got the likelihood. It's a product of 1D Gaussians because we're assuming they're independent. We replace the epsilon I by Y minus A minus BX, and that's us got our likelihood. So now, let's maximise that likelihood. Now, maximising the likelihood is in fact equivalent to maximising the log of the likelihood, because log is a monotonic function. And sometimes that makes it easier, and this is one such case. If you work out the log of the likelihood, it takes this form, minus n over 2 times log 2 pi minus these two terms. From the point of view of the things we're interested in, which is A and B, all this stuff here is just a constant. Doesn't depend on A and B. So we can write the log of the likelihood as a constant minus a half times S, where S is the sum of the squares of the residuals, which is the thing we worked with at the beginning of this section to do ordinary least squares. So what you see is that maximising the likelihood is exactly equivalent to minimising the sum of squares, because if we minimise this thing S, we will automatically maximise the log of the likelihood, and hence the likelihood. So least squares and maximum likelihood are formally equivalent, but only in the case where the errors are Gaussian or normally distributed. If the errors aren't, sometimes they might not be, then you've got to be more careful. Okay. Right, well, thank you for bearing with me. That's a good point to stop. We're just at the beginning of part two, parameter estimation. Okay, so can I suggest that we reconvene at 20 to 4, and that gives us half an hour to recharge our batteries. Thanks very much.